Today, I'm kicking off this podcast again with Kyle Hamrick, a motion designer, creative and technical director, and Adobe certified instructor. I've been studying motion for the last 3 years and integrating that into the skill set that I've already built with music, sound design, and video creation in general. So I wanted to kick off this podcast again with Kyle, who also happens to be one of my teachers. I landed with Kyle a few years ago through some searches online, and as well as just being incredibly friendly and great and down to earth, he's also incredibly skilled as a teacher and as a craftsman. And I wanted to bring him to you guys today to understand the broad picture and landscape of motion design, which is a really young but huge field and growing all the time. We cover topics like the craft and evolution of motion, because he's been around in it for a long time, specialism versus generalism. Kyle would describe himself as a generalist. Learning journey of motion design, so how you start out, what to do, where to go. The future of motion design tools, and also AI, of course, in a motion designer's workflow. I hope you guys enjoy. You can find Kyle on social at Kylosaurus Rex, Kylosaurus Rex, and kylehamrick.com. Enjoy. So you've been doing motion design for a long time. I'm interested in how you see the craft and the tech of motion design having evolved over that time.
Oh,
and
boy.
Then kind of just like a kind of broad overview of like where you see the tech and craft of motion design, the broad landscape lying today. Mm-hmm. Not you as a specialist in certain areas. If you are a specialist, you may consider yourself a generalist, but like if you were the Uber motion designer today, what would your skill set look like? So yeah, where we've been and where we are today for both those things.
I mean, that's a good question. I think, probably the biggest overall answer is that motion design as a craft and an industry has matured a ton since I first got into it. I started doing motion graphics and, you know, being an After Effects guy in 2004, I want to say. That's a long time ago. back then, motion design, or motion graphics as the normies call it, barely existed then. It was more sort of doing compositing tasks, a lot of green screen stuff. And, then you would like put some graphics in that sometimes, but, sort of the whole concept of, the what we think of as motion design today, I think was still very much in its infancy. So there's been a tremendous amount of development in both the tools and just the concepts. Like when I got into it, I came from being a video editor and I had no design background and no animation background. And so I kind of learned those two things on the fly as I went. And, as I implied, I kind of started doing a lot of green screen work, compositing, and then, started putting words behind people and that kind of stuff. And, so it goes from there. But I lost the thread of where I was going there. Between now and then, everyone has sort of realized that you do need a design background and you need to learn animation fundamentals and all these things to be able to make good stuff and just to be competitive in today's market. I think the bar has raised a lot higher because a lot of the education for this stuff has developed a lot and become a lot more available than it was at the time. You're not learning everything from a book. There's just video everywhere teaching you how to do stuff, a million tutorials, a million, structured paid courses, everything in between. I think the ability to become a motion designer or, whatever label you want to put on yourself, a maker of things. I don't particularly like the label of content creator because it sort of feels like it just commodifies and devalues the stuff that we spend a lot of time and effort making. I don't know where I was going after that.
It's fine. Yeah, no. So it Darn started, I was interested in your journey and the way that you've seen it evolve, and it's obviously gotten broader. The skill set has often gotten wider. So where does it, and you've evolved that naturally as the industry has evolved, like rather, maybe you might even call it unintentionally, although you'll have gone through periods where you're like, I need this skill, I need to grow this. It's sort of just happened. Whereas for someone like me coming into it more recently, it's more obvious the lay of the land and the things. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's a little bit reminiscent of like development. Like when a developer starts thinking they're going to be a developer today, it's like, oh, holy, there's a lot of stuff I could do. What should I do? What should I focus on? What tools and stuff like that?
Yeah.
So you mentioned at the beginning, like compositing, obviously video editing. Then there's other things that stack on top of that today. So just above those two, can you kind of break down the way that you see it? And again, it's just your opinion, the way that you would bucket all the different skill sets or crafts or tools within either just a program within something like After Effects, like from rotoscoping to the effects to the, you know, the shape layers, all the way to different types of software that are coming out today to do 3D and other things.
Yeah, it's crazy. Maybe the best way to frame this, I've been, for reasons that are still somewhat beyond me, I've been spending a decent amount of time on After Effects Reddit lately. And there are a lot of posts from people that are clearly young and they have seen something cool, usually on Instagram or the TikToks or something. And they, you know, ask, how do I make this effect or how do I do this edit? But, you know, more often than not, the answer is like, learn these eight things of how, you know, this is like a high-end professional thing that, you know, probably a team of 20 people worked on to create this. So it's not, there's no one button answer. And it's interesting because, you know, there's awesome stuff everywhere and a lot of these tools are super accessible, but, you know, the flip side of everything being very accessible is that the bar does kind of keep getting higher to be able to make stuff that's interesting and cool. And to your point, like to be, it depends a lot on, you know, what kind of stuff you want to make essentially, but to some degree, you need to understand design, you need to understand animation, you need to understand filmmaking. And that's all, you know, variants of storytelling. You need to be interested in what looks good, ideally outside the world of just motion design, so you can take inspiration from other places and not just be copying everything that you see. Ideally, you have at least, you know, some capability in sound design or sound editing or some awareness of what works well with music or at least rhythm. You know, there's so much wrapped up into this. It's a weird mismatch. It's a weird mishmash of so many different skills, which is probably part of why it's been kind of this, I don't know, odd thing that only developed, you know, in the last 20-ish years. 'Cause to be a motion design generalist or a motion graphics generalist or composite, you know, whatever, it's even hard to like give one term of what you are when you know these tools and these skill sets, because you can do a lot of different things, whether you're working 2D or 3D or both, or mostly doing compositing and visual effects. You might be using the same tools in a different way from someone who's making, you know, a video, I don't know, corporate videos where balls move around and depict some, you know, synergies or whatever. Like ultimately it's all kind of the same thing, but you know, they might look vastly different. And I don't know. It's
so
a lot.
as someone who may, would you describe yourself as a generalist?
Absolutely describe myself as a generalist. So which some people would argue is a specialty in itself.
So just, let me know.
Yeah.
Maybe break down what you see a generalist today and the way that they work as opposed to a specialist. If you know people who are, you would describe as specialists.
Yeah, I do. And to be fair, I am a specialist in certain things as well. But, you know, I would say maybe someone who spends almost all of their time being a designer for other people to animate those designs. I would consider that a specialty. But I, for example, I'm an okay designer. I'm a pretty darn good animator. I'm very good at technical workflow kind of things. And then in addition to, you know, knowing, say, After Effects really well and being knowing just enough to be dangerous in some various 3D apps, and, you know, being decent enough at sound design and music editing and having just enough music knowledge to know how to work with rhythm and edit things well and yada, yada, yada. And then I have this big video editing background as well. And I've been a freelancer for 13 some years. So I have all of the producing and project management and client management and bookkeeping skills and all that kind of stuff. But that for me is being a generalist. But for a lot of people, that might mean something very different. If you spend most of your time working, for studios, for example, if you're a generalist who works for a studio, you wouldn't have all of that entrepreneurial skill set that I've had to develop out of necessity. So ideally some of those points would go into you being a better animator and designer than I am, for example. Not knowing how to do your own accounting and client wrangling and stuff, that's probably fine for a lot of people because that part's not particularly fun. but it's very necessary if you want to be your own entity.
So I got there: design, animation, both 2D and 3D, sound, film and editing, and then project management is the kind of the broad skill sets. So describe to me like someone that you might have met who is like the epitome of a specialist who doesn't have things. Like they just know how to work with like rendering settings inside of Redshift or something. Like are there people like that who work today who have like really viable careers?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of those folks, honestly, you probably see them a bit less on social media and stuff like that because they have their niche and they probably stay really busy doing that niche. Someone that comes immediately to mind is my friend Zach Lovett, who has
a legend.
He is very technically minded, and you know, many years ago he kind of gave up being an actual like production artist. He leaned really heavily into the technical side of things and creating tools for others, mostly in the form of scripts for After Effects and some other things. But mostly what he specializes in is making tools or processes for other people's motion design work or related work to be easier or faster or to automate things that need to be done a lot.
And he has tools that you can buy as well as working within teams, right? So like he's effectively working on internal tools. That's a side, obviously, I've always been intrigued in, but I've never seen anything. Have you seen the inside of the way that Zach works with people on teams? Like what are the kind of tools that are different to something you might be able to purchase on AE Scripts, for example?
Yeah. I've had the pleasure of working with Zach a handful of times on things. We've known each other for several years. I have a comfortable relationship with him, but we, for example, it's interesting working on something and, you do something maybe manually a few times. And I also have, I'm not at the, you know, script writing level of Zach or even close, but, I have the mindset of like, this is a thing that could be automated. But that's a thing that he is sort of constantly thinking about, you know, like, oh, is this a thing where we could be, can I spend an hour now to create something that would make it so that this thing takes one click instead of 17? Is that worth the squeeze, in terms of how often it happens and how flexible you need to make the thing?
Yeah. And just to contextualize this for people who don't know that much about motion design,
right?
I have some designer friends, someone who said to me the other day, it's like, I would do motion design if it wasn't so freaking boring. Like, there's a perspective on it from if you don't find the like deep satisfaction of like solving hard technical problems and like making things beautiful and making things move beautifully and things like that, that you just won't do it because there are just so many layers of one, the learning journey, and two, the actual problem solving like situations that you get yourself into.
Yeah.
And one of those is not just the problem solving. It was like, how do I make that move in this way? The other one is like, how do I make this less like mind numbing or time consuming? Because there's a lot of repetition of like, whether you're keyframing things, moving things from here to here over and over again, maybe you can automate the fact that you need to move 100 layers in the same way from here to there, but slightly staggered.
And in the case of a lot of projects, I'm going to stay non-specific here, but let's take, some social media site that is putting something out that is customized for every user, for example. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's one thing for an individual to make that thing and then be like, yeah, I could make 5 versions. But mm-hmm. if you're making thousands or hundreds of thousands of versions, there needs to be back-end automation to take the input and plug it into, you know, specific places that will then make the customized versions of that thing. Mm. And obviously that's a very different level and workflow than most people are doing, but that's the kind of stuff involved when you're, you know, creating stuff that does need hundreds or thousands of versions. And there are other folks. There's a guy named Justin Peterson, for example, who has gotten into the specialty of sports graphics, and he has a YouTube channel and puts other stuff out, helping people learn some of those mm-hmm. technical things. Very similar. I came from doing a lot of sports work for a while, and most of those tools didn't exist. So like, I learned how to build projects so that I could then manually make 50 versions of it for every player on the team and update the name. But, you know, even in that, like, you figure out, how can I build this so I update the name one place and it goes out to the 6 places it needs to be displayed in the eventual exports?
So there's like, there is an engineering aspect to motion design, which is like very, very different to the world of design or traditional design, I would argue. Like, and that's an interesting thing. That's certainly one of the things that like allowed me to get into this being a non-designer. Mm-hmm. So just switching gears a little bit, just going back to that design aspect and how it fits into craft. You mentioned that you said something along the lines of like, I'm an adequate designer or I'm a good designer.
I probably said closer to adequate.
Adequate, yeah. Well, yeah, I'm lacking in design. I'm not a good designer yet, but it is a skill that I like massively respect. And just strangely, when you get into motion design, you do it for a while, and then you've heard this a million times, you realize that design is a word inside of motion design that you haven't really tackled yet. I remember watching you interview, I forget his name, the guy who did the School of Motion Design courses.
Michael Frederick.
Yeah, he's great. Really cool. But I remember that was quite a while ago when you did that interview, and you were saying, I kind of got the impression from you, you were on a kind of an earlier stage of your learning journey with the design stuff. Where are you now with that? And maybe you can also just draw back a little bit and just answer the question of like, how do you see different motion designers varying in their skills with design? Like what's the common attribute? Are most people designers? Are most people not? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if there's any one answer to that, and that's both good and bad. I've seen people that came from a purely design background and started animating things, either because they thought it was fun or honestly, to some degree, I think it's very difficult for someone to purely be a visual designer and not have any animation capabilities today. I mean, if you're really good, then certainly, again, you can specialize and have a particular style that's very in demand. But I think most folks who are doing, you know, day-to-day design work for a company probably have to be able to do at least, you know, if you can animate some basic stuff for social posts and whatnot, like that's probably kind of expected as part of the role at this point. But people that come from a very design-centric background, I've found for context, I've been teaching people how to do a lot of this stuff for 10 plus years at this point as well. And so you learn a lot about the perspectives of people who are coming from different backgrounds getting into this stuff. you know, you kind of alluded to this earlier, but a lot of people who come from a, you know, visual design background may find that they don't have the meticulous personality required to watch the same piece of animation, the same 2 seconds, you know, 100 times, tweaking it ever so slightly. But plenty of people do, and then they can make amazing stuff that looks really good. And some of those folks may be less technically minded than I am. That's always been sort of more my strength, is technical stuff. And so, you know, my ideal is usually working with someone who is a good visual designer, and then I can help bring their things to life. I think to kind of take it back to your question, honestly, most of my design skills I have learned from Michael Frederick. And he's excellent. And really excellent at helping communicate those concepts as well. And I think that I am a capable enough designer, but rarely great. So, you know, I can get it done, but I try to hold myself to a high standard when I'm making things, especially for someone who's paying me money. Mm-hmm. And so, I would rather have someone who is really good at that piece make those things, so that then I can focus on the things that I'm really good at.
But the filmmaker in you, I'd imagine, has sometimes, well, yeah, I'm interested whether you work similarly to the way that I work sometimes, where you're good at the wireframe stage, you're good at the planning, the pulling together, the project management, the vision, like the, what it should do. It's just like the nuance of the style. Do you get involved in that earlier stage? Like, I kind of like, I have a designer in between the early wireframe stage video and when I implement it. And that's the bit that I can't do. And I'm not working. Same. To be fair. Like, I'm not right. Yeah. So like, what's your approach then when you're doing the wireframe or the animatic or whatever you want to call it? Like, how high fidelity do you make it? Do you like bring in reference, or like, how do you articulate what it is that you're trying to design or you want them to design?
Yeah. I mean, it depends a bit on what it is, of course. And I feel like that's my answer to everything.
Sure.
You know, for folks who are not in this industry, you may be getting the vibe that it's, tends to be squishy. And I think that that's largely true because, you know, as I described, you could be using these very similar skills to make all kinds of things that look vastly different. Or you could be making things that look identical in two very different ways. You could come at it from very different approaches and end up with a very similar end product. So I don't know if that's helpful or intimidating, but
no, and just drawing back on, like why that is. I mean, I'd be interested in your perspective, like why it's squishy. Well, like in a sense, like you could say that like making. Oh, I heard a great quote that I'm going to forget the other day, but someone described the difference. It was actually my friend Joe, who's Joe Wallace, is a great stop motion animator. And he said something like the difference between live action is it's live, it's real. The world of motion design and animation is like very poetic and like it doesn't exist, right? Your world building, right? And so to say, you know, world building, or you can do anything that you want, right? So that's why it's so squishy.
Yes,
to an extent, even though it's broad and wide, the skill set of a video producer or a videographer, I might say, or like even a film producer, it's huge and broad, but it's less squishy because like there are maybe like there are only certain, there are rails around it, whereas motion design is like, what do you want to make? It's a blank
canvas. Yeah, there's so much like again, it all depends on what you're making, who you're making it for, yada, yada, yada. But, how do you depict the concept of strength? If you have a camera and another human in front of you, they probably flex their bicep or lift something big, right? Like it's pretty straightforward. Yeah. I mean, obviously you can get more abstract with it, but there's sort of a limited number of things that you can do. But how do you depict strength if you have no boundaries whatsoever? You could make an animated version of a person doing any of those things, or you could make a circle. And that circle could move in a way that communicates strength simply through the way that it moves. And yes, that sounds very abstract, intentionally so, because that's sort of the point of a lot of this. And to take it back to your question earlier, you know, when you're wireframing, when you're doing very early concepts, you might be figuring things like that out, and you're just working purely with, say, a black or white background, and then a few basic shapes like circles and squares, just to figure out kind of the basic composition of each shot, because you're not just figuring out what does that concept look like here. You're looking at what does that concept look like here, and how does that relate to everything around it, both before and after, because this is a temporal medium above all else. And so everything that an audience has already seen is going to inform what they're looking at now, and what they're looking at now is going to inform everything that they're about to see. And so you both have to be communicating everything in a way that helps keep that consistent, but also keeps things interesting, because you need to give people change and contrast and, maybe a variety of different visual compositions, a variety of rhythms, so that things stay interesting, or maybe none of that. If it's supposed to be a very, straight-laced, straightforward sort of project, but you still need to maybe communicate information, and you want people to not fall asleep. So, like those are your boundaries.
The two things that you spoke there that made me think of, like, one was why I was so, like, just my background was in music, was what I thought I was always going to do forever. And then, like, there was various things that shifted, and motion design kind of came up as this kind of like new passion. And for a very long time, maybe like a year or two, I was like, why am I into this? Like, this is not the person I thought I would be. This is not the thing I thought I'd be doing. And after a while, the kind of answer came to me. It's kind of like, it's this, you've heard this many times, but it's like this beautiful synergy of many, many different things. Like you'll hear motion designers talk about rhythm. You'll hear motion designers talk about composition, texture, like flow, story, narrative, energy. Like, it's this wonderful way where you bring in, I can't find a useful way of saying this, or a non-cheesy. It's like, it's almost like all of the things that you experience in life, you can put on the screen in front of you.
Yeah.
And emote those, or play them out, or point to them. And it's like bringing design to life with visceral experience and music and emotion. So it's a very beautiful thing, but that can get pretty squishy, right? Like,
And you very much feel a lot. If you start following a lot of motion designers and get to know them, or animators, or again, whatever you want to call us, and different people call themselves different things, you will tend to see people's backgrounds in their work and in the things that they're clearly interested in and influencing their work and all that. And you'll find that there's a tremendous overlap in musicians and motion designers, because they are not too dissimilar.
Okay, so let's bring it back to your craft then. We've like talked about the design element and things, and we've talked about the fact that you may describe yourself as a generalist, even though you have specialities. What's one area that's not design that you, if you could wave a magic wand, or like eat the red pill or whatever the analogy is, you would just be awesome at, like, straight away? Like,
yeah.
A skill set that you don't have, that you wouldn't have to put in any time to do, you could just get it right now.
Yeah. So this answer comes from more of a marketability standpoint than something that I actively desire, I would say, but 3D. Because many years ago, I made a relatively intentional choice to not really devote too much time to 3D, especially, 15 years ago, a lot of 3D stuff looked pretty bad. And especially like when you were getting started, your stuff was going to look real bad for a long time.
I remember I didn't go near it until I started seeing like Redshift renders. I was like, oh, right, it can actually look good. Like 3D is like bad until it's at like the 98th.
I think it has gotten a lot easier to create stuff that looks good much earlier, which is both good and bad, because then it creates these unrealistic standards. And the reality of 3D is that ultimately, I do think a lot of people tend to specialize more in that, because it takes so much work to model something from scratch and then texture it and light it. And I mean, you're doing cinematography just in a virtual space, which also means, again, that you both have boundaries, but also no boundaries, because you can break all the rules that you would have to obey in a, mm-hmm. in the physical world with real cameras. Mm-hmm. So it's a tremendous amount of work if you're making something from scratch. And that, you know, there's plenty of people that just take models from somewhere else and light them pretty. And I'm certainly not discounting the amount of work and skill involved in doing that well. But 3D is a skill that I think most people need to have at least some of, and I have some of. Kind of like I would rely on a designer. I've always just sort of relied on a lot of talented 3D folks I know. Like, you can make that thing for me, and then I can import it into my project and turn it around in front of the other things that I've already built. And that's probably fine. Mm-hmm. But if I could magically learn it without spending years getting good at it, that would be probably pretty profitable.
Interesting. So, and you're only in this for the money, I know, Carl, so that makes sense.
Yeah, obviously.
So that brings me to another question, which I had in mind, which is about motivation. Like, mm-hmm. obviously, I assume you're passionate and interested in motion design. Maybe you're just in it for the money, as I said.
Clearly, right.
If you were to zoom in and just like quiet down the noise about all the other things that you do to try and get as close as possible to the core of what it is that you love about it. Mm-hmm. And you can describe this in terms of the final output or the process, the experience, the little tiny features of the day-to-day work, or both. I'd love to hear your perspective on like what it is that sustains you through a day of motion design, through a week, through months, regardless mm-hmm. of like the output, really, I suppose.
But yeah. Well, like most of my other answers, I'm probably going to give sort of a meandering, complicated answer.
Love it. Go for it.
So I'm going to split this answer into two parts. Part one, making stuff. I like the fact that I can make pretty much anything. Some things are going to look better than others, but you can see a weird thing on a walk and be like, huh, that would be interesting if I kind of remade it and then made it move in some way. And you can just bring those ideas to life and make them into things that ideally other people also want to look at, which I would not say is my primary motivation. I think in general, and this has to do a little bit with, what we talked about pre-show with motivations for making podcasts and stuff as well. Mm. You absolutely should be doing it for yourself first. Mm. Because if your heart's not in it, you're not going to be doing it well, or it's not going to be sustainable. But let's also be realistic. And if you're putting a ton of work into something that no one else cares about, that's very hard to sustain as well. So ideally, you're making something that other people find some kind of value in. And since most of us are doing this as the way that we pay the bills, ideally it's something that other people find value in and then want you to make stuff for them. Part two, as I alluded to, I have been teaching other people how to do these things for something like 10 years. And I find that really fulfilling and valuable, because one thing that I have accepted after people told it to me many times, is that one thing that I'm really good at is talking about how to do this stuff. Mm. And, so there are a lot of folks, who might be way more talented designers than I am. And they might have, you know, a million concepts that I would never come up with. Bring those ideas to life in a way that isn't going to be frustrating for them and make them stop, their second time opening After Effects or whatever. Mm-hmm. If I can make that easy and approachable and non-intimidating for them, that is a thing that I really enjoy. And because I've been doing it for quite a while, I'm very comfortable doing it. And so I have turned it into a thing where I feel like I can just be myself and like make bad puns and silly jokes and do weird stuff that's fun for me while I'm very effectively teaching people how to use these tools. And so if I can just kind of have fun and enjoy myself and help other people learn something that's valuable to them, then that's, you know, super motivating for me as well.
So as part of your like ongoing development as a motion designer, it's not just for the output, it's also for the passing on. That's part of the motivation. Yeah, I would say it's the same for me. And as one of your students as well, like I would say, I very much respected the way that you approached teaching and just the way that you would approach a problem or motion design. It's like it has this great balance of relaxness and chilledness, but like incredible methodicalness, if that's a word. And yeah, you're just very robust just in the way that you approach. You what?
I said I think it just became one.
Yeah. And that's really cool. And that's a great aspect to have in a teacher. But I'm interested in like just away from the teaching, like your own process with that. It makes me want to ask the question about like, how does the strain of developing as a motion designer or the difficulties in the problems that you face and like how difficult it can be play out? Like strain versus effortlessness is obviously such an axis in someone's craft and skill set. And how does that play out? Do you find yourself really frustrated sometimes, or I imagine you've worked out a way to slowly ease into something that's difficult and not try and tackle it all at once? Yeah, anything that comes up from that I'd be interested to hear about.
That is an excellent question. I think more often than not, I kind of relish a technical challenge. A lot of this stuff is creative problem solving, and you might say have an image and you're like, well, how do I bring this to life? Or, you know, not uncommonly, you might see some other animation sample and like, how can I recreate this technique? Or how can I recreate something similar, but evolve it into a new thing or make it more customizable or whatever the case may be? And that aspect of problem solving is something I really enjoy and nerdily admit that I will sometimes do just for fun. I think where I tend to hit the wall more often and run into frustrations and, you know, start questioning my entire career path and all that is the creative problem solving aspect. The actual like conceptual, to take it back to my earlier example, like, how do you depict strength with just that circle? And I think that there are other people that are a lot better at some of that stuff than I am. I think my strength does tend to be more, if someone else has kind of the initial spark, and that could even just be like one sentence, I can take that and run with it and expand it and all that. But sometimes that initial thing can be a challenge for me, as well as like the polished design aspect. But, maybe that's just being able to get out of my own head. But, cause again, I think I'm, you know, perfectly fine at it and way better than 99.9% of the population and all that. But, there are definitely others who seem very effortless at coming up with awesome concepts and interesting metaphors and all those sorts of things. And I feel like that's less my strength so much as being able to see that concept and say, aha, well, I know how we can make that. I do think ultimately I'm a technician at heart. And so, maybe that's just the part that's more interesting to me.
I wonder about that as you say it, because at this stage in my life, I would say I lean more towards what you're saying. But in a previous stage of my life, I leaned way more to the former, like the bright brain stuff or however you want to think about it. And in a sense, like maybe it's a question, like I've thought about this with myself, like I work in a great trio in my work with a product designer, brand designer, and then me. And there are a bunch of projects that have come out of that, videos, like launch videos that have been like really, really brilliant. And they are absolutely not things I could have done on my own because of the design side, obviously, but also because of the conceptual, like framing, messaging side. But I do think given enough time, I could get something pretty close. But the problem is time, right? Obviously, and willingness and interest, because you have to go into three squishy areas as opposed to kind of like this more like, Or maybe the two squishy areas are the design phase and the, for me at least, and the whatever you want to call it, the messaging phase, because I know how to iterate and solve a problem in After Effects because there's something quite functional and blocky about that.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, right now, I find that a bit more satisfying and calming as well, because mm-hmm. like I can get into a flow. Like there's a nice balance of certainty and variety, obviously like two important needs. But those squishier areas are like, I think that they would be possible, but I think maybe it's just about deciding that you want to give that time over to the squishiness.
I think so. I mean, ultimately, these are all muscles that you either use or don't. Yeah. And, you know, the more you use them, the easier the thing will be. Mm-hmm. And if you are interested enough to spend a bunch of time practicing that thing, then you'll get better at it.
There is something as well about motion design in any video creation, particularly motion, is like how like high fidelity it can get. And then mm-hmm. how much time has gone into this one thing, which happens so quickly.
Yeah.
And then the effect on you as a motion designer watching someone else's work, there's almost like this default mode where you go, they must have made that quite quickly, or like, how did they do that? And you don't see this sort of like 2 months of work that go into it.
The dead ends of R&D that maybe got really close but couldn't quite achieve that thing.
Yeah, and the messy comps and like all of that stuff. Kind of interesting. Just shifting gears a little bit, like just before we shift gears, I'd love to know who some of your, I don't know what the right phrase are, like people you admire the most as motion designers or anyone in your industry, perhaps as well. I might be able to show some of their work in the podcast as well on YouTube.
All right. So I'm going to maybe take a little more non-traditional route, and I'm not just going to pick, you know, some designers that are making awesome work, because there are plenty of those. I'm going to pick some people that I think, because I'm in sort of this weird, I still make stuff, but I also do a lot of talking and teaching about this stuff. And so I'm, you know, become more aware of that as a skill set as well. One of the folks that I've really been liking lately is a guy named Adam Bennett. He it also goes by Video Shop London. And he has been making some really great YouTube content lately. I believe he's also a teacher in real life. And he makes good stuff, but he makes funny, informative tutorials about it as well. He does a good job of like cutting in a lot of movie clips to the tutorials and stuff, but in a way that I don't find annoying and over the top, like, I think a lot of younger people would probably make.
Oh, I hate young people.
But I think he's been making some really good tutorial content that's very educational, but also fun to watch, and makes a good end product as well. And from some of my LinkedIn exchanges with him, he seems like a fun guy as well. Of course, like I think we kind of have to mention a few of the kings of this kind of stuff, like Andrew Kramer, who has largely vanished off the face of the earth, but he was pretty foundational for a lot of folks. And then Joey Korenman, who started School of Motion. And I do think the existence of School of Motion helped raise the bar in the industry quite a bit, making more people realize like, oh, we have to understand how to animate and not just have everything move clunky and mechanical all the time. Mm-hmm. He did a good job of building a little empire that helped a lot of people learn stuff and a lot of people, become part of the motion design community, mm-hmm. that maybe wouldn't have. To add yet another weird tangential skill set onto myself, I think, helping create community in this industry is something that I have done and tried to do. And a lot of times it's pretty easy to just like, hey, let's have a meetup and talk about the things that we like to talk about that our spouses are sick of hearing about. Because they don't care about the new After Effects plugins and, Amanda Russell is also a great name to add to this list. She is part of the team that runs Cream Studio in Virginia, here in the States. And she has also, especially over the last couple of years, become a lot more visible and vocal about, you know, her role running a studio and her role, you know, as a woman in the industry running a studio, which is still fairly uncommon. And also is pretty open about the fact that she's massively uncomfortable talking about herself doing all those things, which I think that's the that's a little bit the secret of a lot of this stuff. Most of the folks, I'm sure there are exceptions, but if someone is in a creative industry and you hear them talking about that process, more often than not, they're probably pretty uncomfortable doing that, because most of us got into this profession because we were the weird kid drawing in the corner, not like the popular kid. And so I think for a lot of folks, the concept of public speaking and focusing all the attention on you is not the comfortable option.
I do find that an unfortunate feature in reality in the way that it works, that often the people who are the best at what they do or the most amazing are not necessarily the best teachers and not necessarily talking about what they do.
True.
And that's not to say that the people who are talking about it aren't good. It's just that very often it is very hard to find the top 1% or the top 2% and get the information out of them.
Yeah.
And even in today's world of like just media everywhere and people talking about what they do everywhere, it's still sometimes hard to find the wheat from the chaff, or whatever the phrase is, like find the good stuff, right?
Because and let's be honest too, that there's a huge difference in being good at talking about stuff and being interested in making the exact format of content that social media promotes. Because those are two very different things. And like, can you teach anything in a meaningful way in 60 seconds?
And there's also another tension.
When, you know, not saying anything because no one listens with sound, like, sorry, this is a totally different rant, but.
I agree. And there's another tension as well, which I feel all the time, like working obviously with motion, which I want to teach in future and just starting to, but also my role as an educator at Glide is that like, there are weeks that go by sometimes where I haven't used Glide, right? Which is crazy to me. Like in the beginning, I was an expert at it. And now I would not say I'm a Glide expert. I would point people to the Glide experts. Mm-hmm. And I work with Glide experts on the more advanced stuff because I'm very busy teaching it. It's like this weird... Like,
and having a life too, which is ultimately the point of
a life. What are you talking about, Kyle? I'm a parent.
Exactly. That's ultimately, that's the reason that we do this stuff, right? Yeah. Like, you know, we're talking about all these... technical specificities and all these things, but like, you know, I do this so that I can pay for my house. and I do this stuff because it is creatively fulfilling and it's fun and, all that, but ultimately it's my job. It's my career. Whether I'm making things or talking about them or whatever the case may be. And so you do have to constantly have that tension of art for art's sake and paying the bills. And, you know, the latter one out of necessity has to win more often than not, so that you hopefully, if you're playing the game right, you can do the things that pay and find the right things that pay enough so that then you have more time to do the fun things, which ideally hone your craft more and get you the better paying things. And it's this self-perpetuating cycle, but
yeah,
it can be a grind too.
Well, this is a very good segue. We love segues, which is in, I wanted to ask a little bit about the business side of things. I listened to your podcast the other day on the freelance podcast or whatever it's called. You talked a lot there about kind of your approach to it. One question I wanted off the back of that to ask just quite concisely really is like, if you lost all of your clients and connections today for some weird reason, if I wove this magic wand and you just lost them, but you could just start again with, and you still have the skills that you have right now, What would you do in that first week to kind of like kickstart your career again?
Finally make a demo reel again.
Well, that is the great thing about people who are in lots of demand is that they rarely have time to make those.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's a good sign now, but yeah, okay. After the demo reel.
Yeah, I mean, I would be more intentional about marketing myself and
what is that? What is marketing?
Well,
because there's so many things you can do in marketing.
So many things.
Waste of time. Like for you, what are the top, let's say the limit it to the top two. If you could only two marketing activities, what would they be as a motion designer?
Well, this isn't entirely theoretical because I'm probably going to be doing this year. Again, my answer is going to be a little bit tailored to me because of my weird, general but specific skill set. And probably what I'm going to be aiming for is to not stepping on Zach Levitt's toes necessarily, but to be that technical solution for studios and production companies and stuff who don't have that person on staff already. Mm-hmm. And where they'd be able to call me and have me come on, you know, even if it's just for a day or a week on a bigger project or something, and help them figure out those technical aspects so that their talented artists can be talented artists and not waste their time going in circles trying to figure out these technical problems that are necessary to solve to be able to finish the project, but hopefully let them work faster. And, you know, whether that's building a little rig for them or just pointing out, like, you should be using this effect stack or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. So that they can do the thing that they're good at and not do the thing that they don't want to spend their time on. And so figuring out how to market that extremely specific niche is something that I am actively working on because it is a weird... you know, it's essentially, it's not too different from building tools for motion designers. It's mm-hmm. just the squishy version of that, right? Mm-hmm. So was that an answer?
What would the two things you do in your first week be with marketing? I didn't really got the answer.
I mean, I think doing a better job of getting good case studies together. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of half-ass ones right now. But perhaps sort of the opposite of what I said a few minutes ago, I don't know that a demo reel is going to be helpful at all for marketing that skill set. So, as I implied, this is something I'm still actively figuring out.
Yeah.
Because you are marketing to a very specific customer base, which is very small. Who already knows what you do. Like, you don't have to explain what it is so much as why you can solve it for them, mm-hmm, something mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's the answer you were looking for, but it's the answer I have.
Like you're living into the answer right now. So yeah, yeah. Okay, that's cool. Okay, so just to round off then, I want to just ask a little bit about where you see the industry going, if you mm-hmm. have any opinions on that at all. And if you don't have opinions, maybe just like do some dreaming and like some brainstorming.
I've got opinions.
Like, I'm interested in one, the tool side of things, mm-hmm. like just bringing some random things to mind to spark a conversation. I'm thinking of things like Fable, the tool, and mm-hmm. Cavalry, obviously on the 2D side, the Spline, these kind of more younger web-based usually tools, not Cavalry, but
Rive.
Rive, obviously. And just the world of motion seems to be expanding a lot for obviously the web as well as video. So I'm interested in, where you see that's going, what's interesting to you, what are you learning, if anything, what would you like to learn? And then we can just towards the end delve in a little bit to the role of AI.
Therein lie the opinions. Yes, I think motion design, because, you know, I think we finally got over that tipping point where everyone realizes, like, oh, yeah, this is a thing. It's everywhere. We're only going to have more screens and more things that need to move.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, you know, it's all just a battle for eyeballs and attention, right? for better or worse, we're all going to be getting constantly punched in the face with everything forever in the future, which sounds awful. But it means that there's a lot of motion work to be had. And I'm really glad to see that the tools are opening up, because for a long time, you know, tools like After Effects, Cinema 4D in the 3D side, et cetera. But, you know, there were a couple of big monoliths, but, and you could absolutely be making these other, say, web content, for example, in After Effects, but it meant that you have a lot of restrictions and you have to jump through some hoops and you have to use some extra tools. And there's a decent amount of trial and error to kind of figure out some of those things when you're doing it, you know, when you're not doing it on the regular. But now there are several custom-made tools like Rive and Fable and Spline to be able to make like web-capable 3D stuff that is potentially interactive. And there's several of these tools. I'm sure, you know, not all of them will survive 5 years from now. We'll probably have some of them becoming, you know, the more prominent ones. But I think it's really great that finally we have some things that are custom made for a modern interactive workflow. And of course, they don't have to be interactive, but they're definitely building off a lot of the foundations of apps like After Effects and Cinema. But for this other use case.
One of my favorite things is like diving into one of those tools and seeing in a more clear way the principles of animation or 3D or whatever it is explored or presented in a different user interface or a different, like, from first principles. Like, I love that about, like, Fable. Like, you know, they bring certain elements that are these, like, well-known plugins for After Effects just natively.
Just built in, right?
Yeah, that should have been built in from the start. That's, I mean, that's a whole other rabbit hole to talk about After Effects and that ecosystem and how its sort of motion design was defined through the plugins in lots of ways, or like the skill set. Anyway, but yeah, I saw a really interesting thread from Guido Rosso, is it? The one of the founders of Rive the other day, where he was saying, I'm seeing a lot of people thinking that Rive is a competitor to After Effects, but it's absolutely not. It's like very different. It's not trying to compete because it's like web-based or interaction-based. And then, yeah, just to obviously that it's very easy to speak to a motion designer or designer or anyone in the visual field these days and mention the word AI and just see eyes roll.
Yeah.
So I don't want to ask the obvious questions. I want to ask the more interesting questions. So anyone who's a novice with expressions or scripting with After Effects has almost certainly played with ChatGPT to see how they can like build their own stuff. I certainly am doing that a lot. I love keyboard-based workflows and like running scripts to do things like that. So I'm building that up all the time. For you, obviously, that's not so relevant or interesting right now, although it'd be interesting to know whether you are using it. What I love about it is it's not the AI generation side of things where you do prompts and you get this uncontrollable like render back. It's like, how do we bring in, it's the embryonic stages of how we bring in like a copilot, and it's an overused word, but like intelligence into our app to do those things like the automations, the stuff that you and Zach do for a living. And I just wonder, like, have you dreamt up or thought about the future of motion design and what a copilot means for a motion designer? Like, way more advanced than we have now. Like, what would that look like for what would be the best scenario?
Yeah, I mean, realistically, we have some of those copilots already in the form of things like RotoBrush.
Sure.
I'm old enough to remember rotoscoping, and that's cutting things out frame by frame, doing that by hand with like 20 masks.
Yeah.
And so I definitely do not shed any tears for the loss of that process. But there are plenty of times where you do still need to do that to some degree, even with things like RotoBrush, which is absolutely, you know, built on machine learning. And there are a ton of same thing, like the generative fill, you know, being able to expand an image. That's a thing that motion designers need a lot. Maybe you get your client gives you an image and it almost works, but you know, you need to be able to zoom in on it or pull out, or you know, you need a little bit more than that already perfectly composed image because you need to be able to move. And to not have to spend 6 hours manually cloning out the extra 10% of the edge just so you can do a little bit of a zoom on it. Like, to be able to do that with one click and get a bunch of content that realistically no one's really looking at. You just need it to exist so that you can focus on the other part.
Okay.
That's great. And that's a great example of the kind of co-pilot workflows that you can have. I think, at least in its current iteration, the biggest problem with using these engines for coding work is, and you'll see this if you ask them other questions, they are extremely confident about everything they say, regardless of how accurate it is. Cool. And so that becomes extremely problematic if you are just saying, you know, make me script that does X. And if you don't have any basis for understanding what it's spitting out, then you have no way to assess whether it's good or not. And it either just works or doesn't. And the issue I see there, it's not dissimilar from a lot of the plugins and things like that that folks use. If you only know how to use, say, I don't want to throw them under the bus, just to make a point here. There's a product called Animation Composer by Mr. Horse, and it's a great suite of presets where you can just slap it on there and like, cool, that has a nice, beautiful, fluid move now, but it's not editable or user accessible in any way. And so it's a great example of something that does something really well, but that's the end of it. It's a good, quick solution, but for folks who don't understand how to make the curves look good themselves, make something move properly in a pleasing way manually, they don't know how to do that. They're using it as a crutch. Mm-hmm. And so they're just taking the easy route. And at a certain point, you realize you've been taking the easy route for 6 years and you never learned how to do that. And you might get a project where you can't use that easy one-touch button and now you're kind of hosed, right? And I do see that as a similar problem with using these chat engines as script generators and things like that. Yes, they absolutely can be useful for creating some easy things, especially for like pretty straightforward scripts. And yes, I have used them a time or two for like, you know, select every other layer in my composition, things like that, that they are useful and you can certainly, you know, type it in, see if it works. And, but I'm not a script writer per se, but I know how to read that code and I know how to assess what it's spitting out and whether that's achieving what I'm after and how I can make that accessible and give it the flexibility that I need it to have to actually be useful and not be just a unitasker that has no flexibility whatsoever, because then it becomes a crutch in my opinion.
Sure.
And with expressions in particular, I think it's very problematic because those by their nature, for folks who are listening, expressions are little pieces of code that you can apply directly to properties in After Effects to do a variety of things. They don't create pixels, but they can kind of augment animation that exists, or they can link properties or other things like that. But if you're using a chat engine to write complex expressions and you have no basis of understanding of what that thing's spitting out, it's very hard to be successful. And, you know, if you can succeed once, great, but then you're not going to be able to replicate that easily and you're not going to have any understanding of what you're actually doing.
Yeah. So the like, I think the best practice really with any co-pilot is always to have the craft around and that supports it and gives it the you know, you're always going to get way better quality output if you know what you're asking and roughly what it's doing as well.
Yeah.
You'd be way more intentional. But just extrapolating out 5, 10, 15 years, I'm interested in how you would guess that AI would be at play in an individual motion designer's skill set.
Yeah. I mean, if I knew the answer to that, I would probably be a billionaire in 5 or 10 years, right?
But this is the interesting, fun question. Like,
yeah,
like let's just, yeah, I'm interested what you might guess.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's impossible to think that the generative capabilities are not going to be a central element in content creation in the near term future. And I don't love that. I hope it gets better and doesn't feel so soulless, and isn't based on, you know, mostly stolen content, but it's kind of here, you know, kind of where we are. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are aspects to that where if we can get it to a point where it looks good, like the concept of being able to, instead of endlessly searching through stock footage, you could create exactly the thing that you want. And, you know, you could be very intentional about who is in that shot, in addition to what they're doing, and what kind of clothing they're wearing and things like that.
Yeah.
Now, let's also be clear, that has all kinds of problematic implications for the rest of the world. but super useful for us who, you know, need a specific shot for this client video or whatever. So, I mean, I don't know where else, where it's all going to go. I think it will be interesting in the next couple years to see, you know, generally what people decide from a legal standpoint. I think will have pretty big implications on how these things can be used in the future. But there's a lot of places where it will be very useful, because you can, if you can create things that you can imagine, but in a way that's actually usable for us, that's the biggest problem right now. You can create neat stuff, and some of it does look very good, but it's just there.
Yeah.
And to do any work with it, you would have to spend as much time dissecting and recreating and all this. And at the end of the day, you're probably not saving a tremendous amount of time through most of it. But I mean, if that changes, if things are able to create generative artwork in workable layers, I mean, that would be world changing for content creators in both the good and bad way.
I think getting the thing I'm most excited about is like the true meaning of Copilot, because everyone's like talking about Copilot nowadays, but it's just text. It's like your text Copilot, right? Which means that if you're a developer or you're writing documents, it's great, right? Yeah. There are these like little, you know, it's like going into these forays with other areas, like, you know, tweaking images, generating images, resizing this and that in PowerPoint. But like the thing that I'm massively interested in is essentially having like a tutor beside me. Like I'm learning very slowly on the side to code, and it's a profound experience having GitHub Copilot and Find and whoever else in my sidebar to ask continual questions about the code and endlessly be patient and explain things. But we're in a paradigm that is completely text. And what I'm crazy excited about, and I really hope happens in my professional lifetime, is where a computer can actually use a pro software, and I can like go back and forth, and I can be like, teach it certain things and say, watch me do this. Like, instead of having to think from a scripting level, like, can you do this, but like more times, or in this way, or like this, or how do I do this, and show me, because then the learning and creative journey is still like between you and the machine rather than this kind of like outsourcing, which is just deeply unsatisfying.
Yeah, I think maybe, and this is an intentionally humorous reference, but I feel like maybe the ideal is that we create a better Clippy, right? So
how much better? A little bit better.
Well, so it's one thing to be, so let's say I'm writing a script for a tutorial, okay? And it's one thing to be writing that, and then I'll freely admit that I use some of these engines as a better thesaurus, for example, because that's something they're really good at that takes a lot of time to do manually. You can go look at the thesaurus.
Sorry, can you say that again?
Tricky phrase. You can go look at the thesaurus And you can spend your time looking through these different words, but you can also just say, what's a word that means this, that starts with P? And now you're not only, you know, creating something that is what you say, but you can like make fun alliterative puns or, you know, whatever you're trying to do. And it can be a little easier to be clever, but could, and maybe some of the, maybe some of these are already capable of this, but to, instead of doing your thing and then stopping and going over here and kind of getting a little thing and then coming back, could you have a thing that's just kind of listening and watching and understands your typical tone and style?
The context window. Like,
yeah, in your context. Window. And then it's kind of watching and be like, I think maybe, you know, you mean this. Or like, hey, you missed up some grammar here. Yeah. For example, like I try to use the like voice to text thing to write things faster sometimes. But I spend so much time fixing the grammar and the capitalization so that I can then read it again later that it takes as much time as just typing the thing. Mm. But that would be a great use case for voice to text, but with actual language rules. Which I feel like none of those have nailed.
Well, I'll give you a recommendation of something that I use that cool. I think pretty much does that. That's Super Whisper for anyone who's listening. And also on the if just from what you said a second ago about the like the interesting use of text, like basically like breaking open the moment, the creative moment, rather than just this transactional, like I give you the question, you give me the answer thing. Like, it's essentially like saying, that's not the right question. Here are some more questions to think about this more broadly, like a great leader. There's a great, like the best implementation of this or the best exploration of it that I've seen is Text Effects by, it's just a lab project from Google. I'll share a screenshot and a link to this in the description, but it's very cool. It basically takes things like a one word, and then it gives you like all of these different ways to think about that word, words in, that are similar in other ways. And it's used by like a rapper as well in the demo video. And it's meant for people who are writing creatively with language and thinking about like, I'm not explaining
kind of doing like word association and things
like
that,
so
which
is so much more. And like, if you had that for design and then one day motion, that'd be like incredible. But like design right now is very generative based rather than like, here's the mother, and like you say,
where ultimately to kind of take it back to part of our earlier conversation, like a lot of it comes out of those initial concepts, is what you choose to try to depict visually, and so being able to sort of broaden your original scope and figure out ways to think about that thing. Of course, you can start asking philosophical questions, like if I'm asking a machine to help me with initial concepts, am I really coming up with the thing? There, you know, you could certainly argue that, yes, I could sit here and manually make a word cloud and spend an hour doing that, or I could spend, you know, 5 minutes and see a bunch of possibilities. And some of those probably give me additional ideas that I wouldn't have thought of. And, you know, it can't, that is a great example of how it could kind of be a co-pilot to just help you get in the right mindset of thinking of possibilities before you, and then you're applying your own creativity on top of it instead of just using it as a crutch, which I think is the part that I have a big distaste for.
Sure. Yeah. So just to round up, I wanted to do some shameless product placement for you and ask how the course is going and where people, what it is and when it's going to be here. And then if people want to find out more about you, where they can go.
Yeah. I am currently recording a course that will be available on School of Motion sometime in the next couple months. It is Premiere for motion designers. So for folks who didn't have my career path, there was a long time there where pretty much everyone making, you know, motion graphics came from a video editing background, but that's no longer the case, which is great. But a lot of folks who come from maybe more of a design background or just got directly into After Effects or cinema or whatever, don't have necessarily that basis for thinking about video editing or for the workflow boosts that you can get by using multiple apps together like that. And to take this back to my earlier Reddit comment, there's a constant thing where people are like, hey, so I'm editing this hour-long video, but After Effects is really slow. Yeah, because that's not where you should be doing that work. It's not built for that. So a huge part of it is use the right tool for the job. Mm-hmm. Here's how it can help you in those workflows. I'm focusing on the interplay of After Effects and Premiere specifically, but you could take a lot of these concepts to other apps if you want to. And then I'm also giving some editing theory, because we've all been watchers of media for a long time. But as you know, when you try to do something intentionally and thoughtfully, you may realize that, I've never had to really think about the implications of cutting something and why two frames might matter. And whether you're using actual footage or cutting content that you're creating in a graphics program, those same things apply. I said this earlier, whatever you're watching right now is informed by all the things that you've been shown immediately before that, right? This is true of a movie or TV show or an ad or a product video or whatever. So thinking about the presentation of information in every sense, and a huge part of that is timing and rhythm and pacing, which is all editing. So a long-winded way of saying that's some of the stuff that I'm talking about in this course, which will be available on School of Motion sometime. And then, among other things, I will be speaking at a variety of conferences. So if you're at any of those, come see me, say hi. You can also find me every Monday on a show I do called Motion Design Hotline with my friend Evan Abrams. And we talk mostly about After Effects, and the show is primarily based on questions that people send in to us, and then we explain how to do those things. Sometimes we just do stuff that's fun for us to explain too, but so there's more of that teaching and silliness, anytime that we can explain things and make it into silly puns or whatever, because it's fun for us and ideally fun for other people to watch and makes them more apt to learn things. So
great. And people can find you at kyle.edu.gov or something like that, right?
Yeah, you can find me at kylehamrick.com. You can find me as Kylosaurus Rex on the various social platforms. There's no E in that. And sometimes there's an underscore, but not always. So you'll figure it out.
I'll put it in the description.
Yeah. fortunately, I have really led the Google search for Kyle Hamrick. I've got like a couple solid pages of content that's me and not all the other Kyle Hamricks. Oh, so
taking up all the space, Kyle.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks, man. This has been great. It's been really awesome to kick off the podcast again with you.
Thanks so much for having me on here. It's been good
great to kick it off again with you. So
yeah, absolutely. Happy to do it. And it's always great to just catch up too. So I'm glad that we can do that and hopefully talk about some halfway interesting things that these good people can enjoy.
All right, man. See ya.